My former partner used to always say, when it's time to start, we should start as if it's a far greater imposition upon those that are ready and on time to start and leave a few that are lagging behind than to impose upon the majority's time waiting for the laggard. So,
or we could just go passive-aggressive.
Oh, we could go passive-aggressive on it? Okay. I'm really happy to be here this morning to be able to introduce our next presenter, Michael J. Stevens. Just personally, I looked at the title of his presentation. I said, this is something I have to see. I was first introduced to the subject in dialogue and have been interested in it ever since. I do not know Michael Stevens, but in short, he is a professor of management and business administration department chair at Weber State University. He has conducted award-winning research in the areas of global leadership, self-managing work teams, and interpersonal competencies. He also consults widely and regularly gives training workshops in the business and nonprofit sectors. For the past 15 years, he has been administering assessments to his students to measure their passive-aggressive tendencies. I would love to see some of the results of those
surveys. Don't wander off.
He's currently serving as the chair of the Sunstone Board of Trustees, and so I present Michael J. Stevens.
Thank you.
Well, we have an hour together, and the first 12 to 15 minutes are going to be interactive, but interactive in a passive sort of a way where I'm going to ask you to spend some time with a paper pencil assessment. I have in my possession copies of the behavior description questionnaire. I will pass it out. It'll take about 10-12 minutes for you to complete. I have a scoring guide, and I will have you score yourselves on the assessment. If you're willing to let me have a copy of your results when you're done, I have a dedicated assistant right here who will tabulate the results on a spreadsheet, and we will put them up on the giant Jumbotron at the end of the presentation. So how many of you are interested in this exercise? All right, we have consensus.
We also have number two pencils.
Can we use a pen?
Pen is fine as well. So the instructions are on the front. I do not have magnifying glasses, but the print is tiny. Need one more?
All right.
So Mary Ellen here will grab the last few. And in the meantime, I'll go ahead and give you a little bit of background about how this particular paper and this study came about. Conflict, of course, is an inevitable part of the human condition. Whether it's between individuals or groups of individuals, conflict flows in a very predictable fashion from incompatible or competing interests, views, goals, wants, needs, desires, and so on. The question is not whether we have conflict, but rather how we choose to deal with it. For most adults in human culture, certain norms and expectations have always emerged over how best to deal with conflict situations. Developing a constructive and balanced approach to resolving conflict is at the heart of not only individual psychological health and well-being, but is also central to the development and maintenance of constructive interpersonal relationships, as well as culture-wide concepts of justice, fairness, and social stability. While some divergence exists, most modern conceptualizations of conflict resolution strategies posit that there are five specific styles or modes that people may deploy in working to resolve disputes and disagreements. These five styles are typically mapped out along a two-dimensional grid, with one axis representing level of assertiveness used in striving to resolve the conflict, and the other, in this case, the horizontal axis, representing the level of interpersonal regard or respect that's employed. Since an individual may be high or low on either axis, independent of the other, the net effect is four distinct regions in each of the corners of the grid, competing, collaborating, avoiding, and accommodating, with a single centralized region compromising in the middle. The competing approach in the top left is by definition used by individuals concerned solely with their own agenda, with little or no regard for the interests of the other party. It's often referred to as, but does not necessarily have to be, a bullying or autocratic style, and is typically described with such labels as imposing and dominating. It also generally deploys such behavioral tactics as pressuring others to comply, making of unilateral and authoritarian decisions, if they can get away with it, pushing to win regardless of cost or impact on others, viewing possible solutions in terms of win-lose outcomes, and using ploys, concealment, and other tricks to obtain the most self-serving outcome possible. The collaborating in the top right-hand corner is the approach used by individuals seeking actively to advance their own interests, but do so in a way that respects, even advances, the interests of the other party. This is often described with such labels as integrating or win-win. Collaborating will generally deploy such behavioral tactics as trust building, seeking the views and input of others, striving to build consensus, promoting self-direction and growth in oneself and others, involving others in constructive problem solving and decision making, openness to disagreements, motivating through natural consequences, and providing honest and meaningful feedback. If you haven't already deduced it from this description, it's important to point out that collaboration is not an inexpensive strategy. It's actually rather costly to attain. Costly in terms of time, emotional labor, psychological resilience, and social and interpersonal capital. As a result, true collaboration happens only rarely in the wild. The compromising approach is used by individuals who have found that a give-and-take approach is a suitable way to reach an acceptable resolution with the other party. Unlike collaboration's win-win approach, compromise, in fact, is just a milder form of the competitive win-lose strategy. It's often used when both parties realize that their opponent will not roll over or cannot be intimidated into acquiescence. When both parties to a conflict are in a position to veto any potential solution, that is, situations where the voluntary agreement or sign-off of both parties is required, then the give-a-little, take-a-little approach of compromising will usually be deployed by both parties. Compromise often leads to what is described as a satisficing solution, that is, a solution which, while not ideal, is at least good enough. It satisfies the bare minimum requirements of both parties for an acceptable resolution of the conflict. The accommodating approach is used by individuals with an unwillingness, for whatever reason, to pursue their own interests, and instead focus on adopting a solution to the conflict that advances the interests solely of the other party. It's often described with such labels of ingratiating and appeasement. It often, though not always, operates from the view that placating the other side will, in the long run, get them what they want. The famous, if they like me or I'm friendly to them, they'll do what I'm hoping for attitude. Accommodating will generally deploy such behavioral tactics as smoothing over disagreements with a smiley face, real or otherwise, the making of few substantive demands, if any at all, avoidance of anything negative, lavishing of praise even when undeserved, and a preference for idle socialization to anything of substance. Finally, the avoiding approach is used by individuals who would like the whole conflict simply to go away. and they act on that aspiration. It's often described with such labels as passive aggression. Passive in that it is by definition unassertive in one's own in pursuing one's own interests, while simultaneously being aggressive, or better stated, while simultaneously being interpersonally hostile, disrespectful, and contemptuous even, or dismissive of the other party's interests, wants, or needs. This is why the horizontal label of the conflict resolution grid is labeled interpersonal regard or respect, or another way of stating is concern for the other's interests. It's embodied in that whatever kind of response to someone who has shared his or her views on a matter. In such situations, the label passive aggression conceptually misleads someone. If I had my way, we'd stop calling it passive aggression and instead start calling it what it is, passive interpersonal hostility. In either case, the avoidance approach will generally deploy such behavioral tactics as keeping one's distance and remaining silent or aloof, hiding one's true thoughts, feelings, or emotions, suppressing, setting aside, or ignoring issues that otherwise should be dealt with, postponing or ignoring decisions, resisting change, and otherwise championing the status quo. The citing of rules, policies, procedures, or higher authority as both a defensive and offensive tactic, and the providing of little feedback. So this is the conceptual background for the study that I conducted. I'll now turn my attention to the particulars of the data collection effort. As a matter of professional activity, I've been teaching courses for nearly 25 years in higher education since I started at the age of 7. Almost all of these courses have revolved around the disciplines of organizational behavior and group psychology. As a result, the topic of conflict resolution has been a theme one way or another in most classes that I teach. As a way of introducing the topic, I frequently use a self-assessment exercise called the Behavior Description Questionnaire, which you all just completed. It allows students in about 15 minutes to determine their preferred conflict resolution style of the five on the overhead slide. This information is then used in class as a platform for discussion and introspective analysis. Over the years, I've taught in both the Midwest and the border regions of Texas, and have developed a general sense for how most students in those areas of the U.S. will typically score on the five styles, with collaborating and compromising being the most prevalent, and avoiding being the least common. In 2008, both personal and professional reasons brought me to Weber State University. As I began to teach my usual rotation of courses and started using the behavior description questionnaire, I began to notice a curious trend with my students along the Wasatch Front. This was true at both the undergraduate and the graduate MBA levels, and for both males and females. Specifically, the preference for avoidance was surfacing at a significantly higher rate than I had noticed in both the Midwest and in Texas. The first time it appeared, I was inclined to treat it as a mere statistical anomaly, just an outlier, something unique to just one class. However, by the third semester, the pattern was clear and unmistakable. There was something different about this student body. So I began to systematically collect empirical data that would allow me to confirm and explore this distinctiveness. Descriptively speaking, this confirmation was quite easy and straightforward to accomplish, as can be seen in both rows 1 and 2 of the table here. Specifically, while the average avoidance scores for my comparison student groups in the Midwest and Texas was a 3.9 on the questionnaire, the observed average score of my Weber State students was 7.5 out of a possible 12 for any one of the cells. It was thus a relatively simple and straightforward matter to establish the empirically clear and demonstrable higher scores on passive aggression avoidance for my Wasatch Front students. However, parsing out the potential underlying contributing factors required some additional demographic data, which also turned out to be fairly easy to collect. Specifically, I started asking students to self-report the following additional information: whether they had been born and raised along the Wasatch Front or relocated there later in life. Number two, whether they were raised in a strong religious environment, and if so, which one. Number three, whether they would currently describe themselves as an actively participating member of a church or a religious community, and if so, which one. And then last of all, their gender. This additional demographic data allowed me to separate out the influences of both religion and Wasatch Front regional factors in the preferred conflict resolution styles I was finding among my students. When this additional data were analyzed, the passive-aggressive avoidance style showed meaningful changes. Specifically, when Weber State students were separated into two groups based on whether they had been raised in Utah or relocated later in life, the avoidance scores went down to 5.5 for the non-Utah natives in my Weber State classes, and increased to 8.3 for those who reported being originally from the Wasatch Front area.
Michael?
Yeah?
Are these in the same order as on the yellow sheet?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, in the complete collaborative, the five columns?
Correct. Across from left to right. Further, when Weber State students were separated into two groups based on whether they self-reported as believing members of the LDS Church versus other, and due to limited sample size, I lumped all non-LDS students into the other category, the avoidance score went from 5.6 for non-LDS and increased to 8.7 for those self-identifying as LDS. Finally, when the category of growing up in Utah was also combined with being raised LDS, the avoidance score increased from 9.2, nearly 2.5 times the average scores of my comparison groups in the Midwest and Texas. It was therefore a rather simple matter to determine that the passive-aggressive response option to conflict exists at a statistically and significantly elevated rate among the LDS population born and raised along the Wasatch Front. It's empirically demonstrable from the results of this very basic data collection effort. As for the reasons behind this extraordinary trend, I offer the following working hypotheses. First, I would argue there exists among many true believing LDS a false and unhealthy view of conflict that seems to conflate all forms of conflict with contention. This most likely stems from an overly simplistic and, I believe, defective reading of 3 Nephi chapter 11, verse 29, which states, "Verily I say unto you, he that hath the spirit of contention is not of me, but is of the devil, who is the father of contention, and stirreth up the hearts of men to contend with anger one with another." If all conflict is viewed as being the functional equivalent of, quote, spirit of contention, unquote, what options does this leave a person who disagrees or sees things differently or has disparate goals or interests? How can one raise objections and question or challenge others or raise unpleasant topics if doing so is tantamount to having the spirit of contention and being in league with Beelzebub? Of course, the dysfunction with this path is clear. If one's view of conflict is that it must be avoided so as not to be contentious, then there is no direct, healthy, constructive strategy available for resolving conflicts and disagreements. Many of our mothers taught us, if you can't say anything nice, go to your room with... Oh, no, that was my mom. Don't say anything at all. And while being civil and polite is an important life skill to master, the Book of Mormon is also very clear that there must needs be opposition in all things. Second possible reason for the elevated LDS passive-aggressive response to conflict would be a false and unhealthy understanding of submission, along with a defective reading of what is meant when the scriptures not acknowledge that Jesus was himself submissive. Those who don't actively engage in healthy and constructive conflict resolution through such options as collaboration and compromise often operate under the misguided view that submitting to the impositions of others means that they are behaving in a virtuous, even Christ-like manner. This very ungodly view of submission perpetuates the Dora the Doormat syndrome, wherein victimization and abuse are accepted even as noble and virtuous events. While the scriptures clearly teach us that Jesus was submissive in all things to the Father, I would argue that this was not submission in either the accommodation or the passive-aggressive avoidance styles. Rather, this notion of Jesus' submission is more properly interpreted as his unwavering and unyielding commitment to the path that embraced charity, compassion, and social justice as the foundational underpinnings of the life and fabric of those claiming to be God's people. In this sense, Jesus submitted without compromise to the wisdom of the path, a path that was in stark contrast to the prevailing views, attitudes, and customs of the Mediterranean culture of his day. This was clearly the basis for his teaching that we turn the other cheek. With this saying, Jesus was not teaching us that if someone tries to hit you, you should let them knock you down, then ball up in the fetal position so they can really go to town on you. Rather, this instruction of turning the other cheek was rooted in the cross-cultural framework that one anthropologist calls an honor-shame culture. In such cultures, one of the most valued ideals is to operate in all public matters and interactions with others in a way that preserves your public honor and respect. Therefore, if someone publicly offends you by slapping you on the cheek, the cultural mandate requires of you to respond in kind in order to preserve your honor. If you don't, you're publicly humiliated, dishonored, and perceived as weak. However, by following the strategy that Jesus suggests of turning the other cheek in such situations, Jesus is telling us to stop the cycle of violence right there. Don't respond to a given offense by giving offense. Don't perpetuate the interpersonal hostility and contempt. Number three. Third possible reason for the elevated passive-aggressive responses to conflict that can be found, I believe, in the patterns of Mormonism's tight versus loose cultural values. Well, this particular taxonomy of culture differences has diminished in interest since it was first introduced. It's recently begun to show a resurgence due to its promise in helping us understand the modern era of globalization and fundamentalist cultures, especially. I find this particular concept of tight versus loose cultures to provide some useful insights for better understanding modern Mormonism. Tight cultures are described as those having many strong norms proscribing behavior and conduct, along with low tolerance for deviance from those social norms. Whereas loose cultures generally have weaker social norms and a high tolerance for deviance among the culture's members. This concept also includes ideas about how such deviance is controlled. If modern mainstream Mormonism can rightly be called an anthropologically tight culture that strongly embraces the norms of politeness, then it's easy to see how norms favoring conflict avoidance, at least along the Wasatch Front, are combined with very strong social sanctions against deviance for this preferred mode of conduct. Another way of framing this concept is through the socially debilitating phenomenon known as groupthink, which frequently occurs among tightly cohesive groups who often strive to isolate themselves from outside influences. They will almost always have clear and powerful leaders who articulate very strong opinions, while simultaneously lacking the collective mechanisms for formally examining alternative solutions. In addition, members of highly cohesive groups often feel an intense loyalty to the group and its leaders. They also tend to be highly homogeneous, making it difficult for heterogeneous outsiders to join and become fully integrated. Because of these reasons, the presence of groupthink almost invariably means that members with disconforming information or contrary opinions do not state them openly or publicly. Or if they do, they must be willing to accept the strong sanctions and social ostracisms that will inevitably follow. In cultures deeply embedded in the groupthink phenomenon, the message is clear. No devil's advocates are allowed. Quit asking questions and challenging things. Just get on board and be a team player. Unfortunately, this easy agreement on difficult and important issues is not a sign of a healthy culture, but a signal of deep, troubling, and abiding dysfunction. Fourth possible reason for the elevated passive-aggressive response to conflict comes also from the world of cross-cultural anthropology and is referred to a culture's power distance. This concept signals the size of the gap in a given culture between those members who have status and power, however that's ascribed, and those who do not. Operationally, this translates directly into the question of how much deference is expected from the culture's average members towards those who have more power and higher status. In any culture, there are always ways in which some individual members are ascribed a greater measure of power, honor, and status within the culture. The basis for this ascription will vary from one culture to the next, but generally tends to fall along the lines and attributes of wealth, caste, family, or extended personal connections, leadership roles, and so on. In high power distance culture, strong norms with attendant sanctions exist that require high levels of deference to people in positions of power and elevated status. In high power distance cultures, this deference will almost always translate into restricted rights, and in some cases, no rights at all, to question or challenge the status quo and the decisions made by those in positions of power and higher status. To identify the degree to which Mormonism embodies the zenith of a high power distance culture, one needs only attend any given LDS church meeting when sustaining votes are called for. Rather than serving as a referendum on leaders' actions and decisions, such votes by LDS congregations routinely function as little more than loyalty tests of members' deference to leadership decisions. In all cases, uniform deference is not only expected, but when such deference is not universally given, through the act of casting a dissenting vote, for example, the non-acquiescing member is invariably brought in before the leaders with the clear directive that the member provide justification to the very leaders who held the vote for his or her deviance. As another indicator of modern Mormonism's high-power distant culture, one also need only look at the responses to anyone who dares to act in a non-deferential manner by openly questioning or otherwise challenging church doctrine, history, rules, policies, procedures, and so on. At a personal and informal level, these responses will often include condemnation, censure, and ostracism by fellow church members, friends, and in many cases, even family members. At an institutional level, it's not that difficult to find examples of honest and courageous people who have had acts of institutional spiritual violence committed against them in the form of church discipline, even excommunication, for daring to openly challenge or question church leaders, church practices, church policies, and church doctrines. In fact, if you hang out with us the rest of the day, you'll see that one of our panels at the very end addresses this very topic. And besides, even if they did, the mantra continues, then the members must still defer, and in so doing, God would bless those members for their obedience. Such morally repugnant and ethically bankrupt logic was the basis for the failed defense of the Nazis during the Nuremberg trials. As in, hey, you can't blame me for doing my job in the concentration camps. I was just following orders. It's nothing less than the wholesale abdication of one's moral agency and the voluntary surrendering to mortal leaders with embodied arms of flesh, the very agency that God herself utterly refused to strip from us in the councils of heaven. And finally, a fifth likely reason accounting for the elevated preference for passive aggression can rightly be attributed to a deeply pharisaical view within the corporate LDS church of how one is supposed to live a life intended to please God. In some key aspects, this is a clear and obvious extension of a high power distance culture. The pharisaical approach on its own, though, can best be described as a rule-based philosophy for pleasing God. To be fair, I admit that I have sympathy for the goals of the pharisaic mission, which was essentially to elevate all of Israel into a higher relationship with God. However, the strategy or means by which they set out to achieve that goal was the basis of their undoing. Their view was that by observing as best they could all of the ritual purity laws in the law of Moses, that is, by living kosher, God would be so impressed with their voluntary obedience that he would have to send the Messiah. In the context of the current dispensation, this equates to a rule-based approach to church governance and gospel living. It's the view that there's safety in just following the rules. Just be obedient and things will be fine. God will be pleased and bless you. However, the net effect of this approach is the creation of a micromanagement leadership style and a highly bureaucratic approach to church governance at all organizational levels. Bureaucracies, though, are essentially the embodiment of passive aggression at the institutional level. These organizational cultures live by mantras such as, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. A profoundly passive-aggressive strategy to resolving institutional conflicts and getting things done. It also leads to a false understanding of delegation and counseling, which gets operationalized as a deeply simplistic view of control and hierarchical leadership that results in the issuing of directives with a return and report mentality of leadership along the lines of, when you've done what I micromanage you to do, come back and tell me so I can check it off my to-do list as your leader. Consequences and implications. In summary, many may ask, so what if the LDS culture has this extraordinarily elevated avoidance approach to resolving conflict? Doesn't it simply mean that we're all just nicer and more polite to each other? What's wrong with that? I would certainly support more civility in our public and private lives. What could possibly be the downside to following the advice proffered in the highly prescient Book of Mormon musical that you just quote? Turn it off, like a light switch. Just go click. It's a neat little Mormon trick. Unfortunately, there are significant dysfunctional implications when we deploy passive aggression and avoidance as the primary mode for conflict resolution. As it turns out, while Mom's advice of just being polite may have worked on a limited basis on the playground and only over the short term, research on the long-term mental health and well-being of adults has shown that in real life, this approach is more likely to lead to artificial and superficially disingenuous relationships, abdication of personal responsibility, perpetuation of victimization with the complicity of the abused, long-term feelings of alienation and resentment that can build to the point of both physically and psychologically violent eruptions, a self-reinforcing downward cycle of codependency between those who lead or unilaterally impose solutions to conflict and those who are subordinate or have the leaders unilaterally solutions imposed upon them without genuine input or consent, fostering the festering and of unresolved conflicts, complacency and stagnation with regard to personal growth, development, and maturation, and the stiflings of creative and innovative solutions to problems. So recommendations for addressing. Assuming one accepts the thesis and findings of this paper, the remaining and for me the most logical question is, how do we address it and move people towards more constructive approaches for resolving conflict and disagreement? To answer this question, I present four barriers to change that would need to be confronted and overcome at the individual level, and one approach for remedy at the cultural level. First, we need to sweep away our blindness to the reality of the situation. The presence of passive aggression among the Latter-day Saints is not something that can be explained away simply as a matter of professional or academic interpretation. It's empirically measurable, an objectively observable fact. Failure to see this phenomenon and to acknowledge its presence among us means we can have little hope that it will ever be remedied. As any skilled physician will tell us, we must first have a good, accurate, and clear diagnosis of the ailment before we move to treatment. Second, we need to have good mental models regarding our options for responding to conflict. While Mom's advice of being polite is fine in its way, it nonetheless limits our options. If we view our response options to conflict as choosing between either competition on one hand or avoidance and accommodation on the other, Then a more constructive approach is like collaboration will be impossibly beyond our reach. Few of us will stumble upon it through our own efforts or circumstances. This is why I say it occurs so rarely in the wild. Limited and even false dichotomous choices unfortunately anchor far too many of us, far too frequently, to some rather dysfunctional, even horrific options. For example, if I were to poll all of you in here and ask, how many of you, if given the choice between death by firing squad or death by hanging, would choose death by hanging? Okay, one timid hand. You're wrong. How many of you would choose death by firing squad? Okay, most hands. You're also all wrong. What's the right choice?
No death.
No death.
Neither. Thank you.
You tricked.
That's the point. If you believe your only options are aggressive, right? Open hostility, competing, or avoiding the whole thing, what do you pick? Death by firing squad or death by hanging?
No, you set it up so we had to answer one or the other, and we didn't have to go up and displace you at the microphone to do anything about it. And that would be great.
Touché, sir. We need to recognize that being polite for its own sake is problematic when issues of substance and import are at stake. That is, we need to stop falsely equating passivity with passivity. Passivity, P-A-S-S-I-V-I-T. We must not confuse that with passivity, P-A-C-I-F-I-T-Y. Being submissive versus being peace-like. And falsely believing that your only alternative is to be competitive and overbearing, which for many of us is an untenable alternative. However, while many of us can easily and quickly see the value in the collaboration mode when it's described and presented to us, seeing doesn't automatically or easily lead to doing, especially in this case. This leads to the third barrier I think we need to overcome, which has to do with limited and inadequate skill sets. In my view, this is where the proverbial rubber meets the road. This involves the art of learning how to disagree without being disagreeable. While this is a noble platitude, it is much easier said than done. My experience has been few of us really know what it looks like or how to actually pull it off. What this means is having the skills to seek, advance, encourage, and foster healthy and functional collaborative problem solving while minimizing the dysfunctional kinds. It means having the ability to accurately size up the conflict resolution behaviors that are presenting themselves in a given situation and organizing the interactions for a constructive response. Fostering a collaborative problem-solving approach, effectively communicating, which overwhelmingly in a constructive way means listening at a ratio of 4 or 5 times to speaking, and being able to adapt and seek the authentic and integral needs of others without holding out manipulative rewards or incentives to get what we want from them. And we need to do all this while holding onto our own integrity and objectives precisely when we are often in the very pitch of emotional distress and tumult from the conflict itself. For these reasons, perhaps the most significant skill set barrier preventing us from moving to more effective modes of conflict resolution is that of limits that we have on our emotional intelligence. This is really more a broader set of generalized competencies, this idea of emotional intelligence, consisting of such attributes as self-awareness, self-regulation, and empathy. This typically requires non-traditional approaches to teaching and innovative instructional methodologies for learning and growth and development. And last, at the organizational level, we must demand better from our leaders. We must demand that they model what is needed. We must demand that they fix institutional sanctions, that they stop rewarding those things precisely that should be discouraged. And I'm talking here about such things as not publicly praising the virtues of Pharisaic behaviors, and rethinking the basis and criteria used for allocating resources and the setting of budgets so that they reflect social justice, inclusion, and authentic self-direction, especially for women of the church. I'm also talking about a wholesale reconfiguration of what constitutes institutional worthiness criteria for such things as the granting of temple recommends and for making decisions about staffing church positions of leadership and authority. We must also demand that leadership stop punishing what should be rewarded. I'm talking here about such things as ceasing to use formal church discipline to sanction those who openly ask questions and challenge the status quo, but instead formally embrace, even champion the idea of publicly wrestling with difficult questions, of not just protecting dissenters within our culture, but welcoming them as an essential agent for production of cultural antibodies that will help do more than anything else to produce a healthy and responsive immune system to the challenges facing the church. Unfortunately, for Mormonism, the very people equipped to help us navigate the future in this manner are precisely those whom we would rightly describe as the loyal opposition, but are effectively marginalized and pushed out. The Catholic Church figured this out centuries ago when they created the official Vatican position called the Devil's Advocate, which is the common lay term used for this official position in the Vatican. The official title for the job of Devil's Advocate is Promoter of the Faith. And of course, when we confront our leaders with these demands, we must do so in a constructive and collaborative manner. To do it with hostility or contempt would be nothing more than the spirit of contention, but to instead just avoid the whole mess would be nothing less than passive aggression on our part. Thank you. Mary Ellen, do we have numbers for the Jumbotron? So, of course, you all in here are not guilty of having been born and raised along the Wasatch Front. So I'm sure our numbers this morning will be significantly different.
I don't know. I kind of skewed him by having one of the three triple-digit numbers in competitiveness.
Oh, there we go. So I'm curious, Levi, you were a professor most if not all your career at Weber State University. Does any of this ring true?
It's true. What was your question?
So you, my data were collected that students at Weber State University, I just stumbled on. I didn't set out looking for these research questions or data collections kind of fell in my lap when I started teaching 4 years ago at Weber State University. You spent your entire career there. I was wondering if any of this resonated with you.
Well, yeah, I don't argue with it. I have a slightly different explanation.
Well, you have questions? Do you want to put anything on the table? We've got, another 5 minutes or so? Thoughts, questions, comments from anybody?
I'm just wondering, given the church's emphasis on submission for everybody, but especially in addition for women in their marriage relationship, their cross-gender lines, is there a difference in these scores by gender?
There was, surprisingly, there not. There, I don't have the gender data, my Midwest and Texas regions. I'm starting to collect it, but the interesting thing is there was little difference between men and women along the Wasatch Front, which is extraordinary because, I mean, just at an anecdotal level, when I saw the lower scores in the Midwest and in Texas, it was almost always my female students. So
the lower scores
in avoidance. But along the Wasatch Front, I'm seeing it among men and women equally.
I'm wondering if you had posed the question in two different ways and had two different question, have them fill them out two different ways. One would be in general reactions among the public, and the other one within one's own family or marriage situation.
Right.
I would have answered mine very differently.
Right. So what the question is that Bill's asking is, as you go through and answer those questions that we did for the first 12 minutes of the presentation, if you put yourself in the context of how do I deal with conflict at home or family versus how do I deal with it at work, you could have very different patterns, and that's true. So I don't prompt people or prime them to think of it in those different ways. But conflict resolution strategies are highly contextual and interactive with the other people that you're working with. So that's important.
It doesn't break down those of us who are autistic.
Correct.
And I'm highly competitive, but in this group situation of trying to work things out, I don't have the eagle base to put myself on the line and then drive it forward.
Yeah.
And so everything's going to be skewed.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's fair. The measure that we have to collect this data is a sledgehammer. In your particular case, it would be more appropriate to have a scalpel. The fellow right behind you, though, is highly gifted and skilled with the scalpel, and he can help you after the session. But that's fair. Other questions?
Coming back to your resolution, as the loyal opposition, how do you even start to implement something like that when you have an organization that is absolutely top down and ignoring that bottom up, and in fact, when there's attempts at bottom-up resolution, you get stepped on.
Yeah.
Rather hard.
You heard a fellow named Mahatma Gandhi?
Yes.
He had some wonderful strategies and techniques. But even that is very simplistic response, because most of us believe Gandhi to be the father of passive resistance. And in our heads, we translate that P-A-S-S-I-V-E. But Gandhi was somebody who says, I don't believe in passive anything. Whenever there's injustice, I believe in fighting. The only question is, how do you fight, what techniques do you fight, and what's your motive? Do you fight to change things, or do you fight to win and punish and beat the other side? And Gandhi said that the competitive approach, the violent approach, is unacceptable. But neither is appeasement, neither is avoidance. What does that lead to? Well, collaboration. And when you're trying to collaborate with an enemy who has the power to overwhelm and squash you, what do? Well, you have to stand up and in whatever mechanisms and whatever institutional ways you can, when they ask you to vote, you vote no. What would civil disobedience look like within the Mormon Church? Well, we're out of time. So I don't mean to be glib or flippant, but that is actually something that we could spend not only hours but months and years contemplating. But to not engage in some kind of pushback in an authentic, integral way would be avoidance. I'm going to come back to you, Levi. Come back. I'm not sure what you mean by work around.
I often realize that something's a dead end, and
okay.
I go somewhere else, and I do something else, and I kind of go outside the conflict and avoid it in a way, but I'm still directly addressing it.
Are you directing it with the people with whom you have to direct it, or are you trying to do end runs around them?
End runs around them. It's
avoidance. I mean, I need to know more specifics, but that's what it sounds like to me.
Well, I'm also wondering, and thinking of it more, even more so from a woman's perspective, like almost just the environment in which people place themselves, that could also be possible explanation. Because I think, like, maybe when you have a workplace environment where, especially if you work in sort of a workplace that is very combative with different ideas, let's throw them up on the board, and I'll argue my idea versus right. your idea. Like, that's an outlet. We're like at right. church, we don't raise up. But even the little kids know, okay, reverence in their minds means quiet. And for housewives, maybe, or homemakers, that we're trying to keep our heaven on earth. That, you know what I mean? So if you spend a disproportionate amount of your time in the home and at the church, you're at these places where everyone's supposed to keep their voices
right.
low, and there isn't an outlet. And then, you know, something like church ball happens and a brawl happens, and it seems so out of
place. And it's surprising that. See, the thing with passive aggression, and even men within the church, this is one thing that I think keeps men from appreciating feminism within the church, and that is, feminism is an understandable response to the patriarchy. But what most men don't appreciate about Mormon patriarchy is that patriarchy is not just the oppression of all women by men. It's the oppression of everyone, including all the other men, by some few men. So in the church, even if you're male, you have to submit to authority. Men, though, we have this kind of relief valve where we know, okay, well, you know, I may be at the low end of the leadership positions in the ward or the stakes, so I got to submit. But someday, I'll just bide my time, and then I get to be in charge. Or I'll, you know, I get to be the stake athletic director, and I'll run that. Or I can go home, and I've always got that psychological relief valve where I can say, okay, sweetie, yeah, you know, my wife and I, and yeah, we're equal partners, but I preside, right? There's an inherent schizophrenia that derails the hope for any true, positive, genuine connection. You know what the word preside means? To be in a position of authority over someone or some group. You cannot preside and have equal partners. That's like me saying, yeah, my wife and I, we're both equally wet, except I'm dry. You cannot have it both ways. And it creates that kind of disconnect where you can never resolve it at home. You can never resolve it at home. If you're really lucky, you might get into one of those few organizations in the world, a nonprofit, a business, or something of that nature, where you can find genuine collaboration. And if it's nurtured, depending on your personality, depending on your experience, depending on your mentality, depending on the temperament, depending on the leaders that you've had, you may stumble onto a good, healthy collaborative model. But in the back of your head, there's always going to be, okay, I know what God wants at church. I know what I'm supposed to do at home. And for many of us, it's difficult to compartmentalize and not bring with our psyche across all these different divisions and paths that we travel through life to have that kind of bleed through. So it's tough. It's very tough.
Troubled a little bit by your word demand, so we should make demands.
Yes.
I would like to soften that a little bit and say requests, or even bring something up. For example, just a little over a week ago, I had an idea which I thought was of some merit, and I wrote directly to the presiding 70 or whatever he's called, Elder so-and-so. Well, anyway, he wrote me back a letter and said he thought it was a real good idea. He was going to forward it on to the area where it would do the most good. And I felt that I wasn't, you know, demanding that he do anything, but I just wanted to bring the question before him, and he was very receptive. I think if we go with demands, we're going to hit a stone wall. If we go with requests and a request to discuss things and so forth, we'll have a lot more success.
Okay. Essentially, what I hear you saying is demand sounds too much like this for your taste, right?
I think if we go and demand something from the church leaders, from the bishop, from the high counselor, the state president, or whatever, they're just going to dismiss it.
Suppose I went to an abuser and said, I demand that you stop abusing me, that you treat me with respect. Would that be inappropriate?
Yeah, if that were really happening, you'd have to define what you call as abuse.
Right.
If you feel that your toes are being stepped on by because you haven't been called to a position of degree of influence or authority, that isn't really, you know, being abused.
I agree, absolutely. So that's for observation, Patrick. Go ahead.
I would amend request to propose.
That's a good word, too.
Aren't we playing semantics errors here?
I think it's a woman's perspective, but a request is automatically something that can be denied. But a proposal is something that invites conversation.
That's a good word, too. I agree.
Levi, go ahead.
The problem with all that we're doing here is that actually the core concept of Mormonism is the unerring leader. And I'm afraid if you get rid of that, if you change Mormonism from a viable religion into a nice secular organism, such as has happened to be reorganized.
So of those two options, would you choose death by hanging or death by firing squad?
Well, my total, I just go to church and sleep.
Go ahead.
So going back to your statistics and particularly the quick poll that you did today, we showed a very balanced score. But what we don't show here are the highs and lows that exist here.
Correct.
And I wanted to, because you can only do this now while we're
correct.
I came out on the avoiding scale, probably higher than most, with a 10.
And you grew up where?
I grew up in Southern California, but
in a Utah house.
In a very Utah house. Both parents being from Utah, very much of that mindset. And I don't know if anybody got higher than a 10 on this, but you may want to study me.
Yes, they're medications for that. But I'm not that kind of doctor.
We're not saying too much about medications, is
it? Levi's comment that you want unerring leaders, I think one of the strongest histories, pretty much subtle now and buried, is the Adam God doctrine, which defined God as Adam in the Garden of Eden and required polygamy. Leads in the Adam God doctrine requires polygamy. And this was buried beginning in 1885, and that's now not tolerated. It is a basic belief of who and what is God. The question is, who errs? The leaders in the days of Brigham Young or the leaders today?
Go ahead.
Well, in the DNC, Joseph Smith was always talking, you know, they said he was a weak man, and there were several scriptures that said he was less than perfect. You know, and he said it himself. So it seems to me that we have built this position of, you know, the non-erring leader as a people, or that submissive, you know, by passiveness we have accepted that position. But really within the document, I don't think there's a real support for that,
right.
But I think we don't know what else to do.
Right.
I was thinking in support of that, a comment I've heard that is that Mormons proclaim an infallible leader and treat him as totally infallible, whereas Catholics proclaim their leader is infallible,
but
they don't believe in it.
Actually, I've had wonderful discussions with students along this very thing, because I now put this data up in class whenever we do this exercise. I talk with my students about it, and they're always two or three or four after that particular class session hanging around, and it's, they got to unload. And a lot of them have that the prophet will leave us a stray mentality. And I simply ask them, okay, well, let me ask you, do you believe that the prophet of the church can err in making pronouncements of faith or doctrine or morals? Very simple question, yes or no. About half of them will say, yeah, I believe that. The other half will refuse to answer it. You won't lead me astray. I said, that's not what I asked. I didn't ask to be believed. I asked, do you believe the prophet of the church can err in making pronouncements of faith or doctrine or morals? And if they say yes, I send them the online Catholic encyclopedia of terms and glossary. That is the textbook definition in Catholicism for papal infallibility. So it's a tough thing to wrestle with. I'm getting the high sign from Mary Ellen. Do you want to have a last word, Patrick?
Well, just one thing. I think one thing that anybody who studies Mormon history and doctrine and all that would have to come to the conclusion is that sometimes errors are made. And that, to me, is a given, and it doesn't bother me at all. If Joseph Smith said such and such, like, I don't personally believe the Garden of Eden was in Missouri, I just think he was absolutely wrong on that, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. It doesn't bother me why an iota. Show me the person who's ever been wrong in anything. And it isn't, to me, it isn't so much a matter of, is the prophet always right? Because if you imply he's not always right, then it almost sounds like he's always wrong. And that isn't true either. Right. In fact, most of the time, I think we should give very prayerful consideration to what he's saying, rather than dismiss it out of hand because we supposedly know better. There's a chance he could be mistaken or wrong, but chances are he's right. And I think we should acknowledge that if we have any morsel of faith in the church.
Or that sounds to me like it would be a wonderful, constructive, and collaborative approach.
But the problem is that we hear that Joseph Smith said he might make mistakes and he's fallible. But then we get down to when we have canonized scripture, which is the doctrine and the standard of all, and then what do? We run into problems such as we're going to hear this afternoon on the book of Abraham. And what do you do about it? Things like that, or reversals that are made on doctrine and faith.
That is a thought that we'll continue this afternoon. We'll maybe give you a whole session on that one. Or at least part of one.
All right, we'll take a 5-minute break so we can get our panelists together up front, and then we will start again.
Thank you.
Thank you.